You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, gift giving is a big part of the holiday season, but not all gifts wow us the way they're supposed to. A psychologist tells us why we give bad gifts and how to avoid doing it. Now, the U.S. military routinely burns their hazardous waste, even though other industries are required to use more environmentally sound methods. This results potentially in billions of dollars that need to be spent on cleanup, along with possible health risks for the communities around those sites. ProPublica just released an interactive report complete with maps and charts for each state that detail the more than 40,000 hazardous military sites and their current status of cleanup. Abram Lustgarten is a senior environmental reporter with ProPublica with a focus on the intersection of business, climate, and energy. He's one of the authors of the Bombs in Your Backyard series. Abram, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
Well, give us the basics of military toxic waste. Where is it all coming from?
Yeah, well, so we've been looking for the last 2 years or so reporting into environmental legacy left by Pentagon operations of all sorts. And it's essentially, pollution from the manufacturing of bombs, the testing of bombs and munitions, and the operation of airfields and various training facilities, whether it's the Army, Navy, Air Force, or National Guard sites across the country. And as you said, there's 40,000 sites across the country, a cumulative acreage of more than 40 million acres, which is just enormous, larger than the state of Florida.
And in many cases, this might be ordnance ammunition that was state-of-the-art in one decade and obsolete another decade, and they've got to do something with it.
Yeah, that's right. So a lot of these sites can be quite historical. Some are from World War I or World War II, and in some cases they've even been forgotten about. But we just published a story yesterday about munitions and chemicals from those munitions, which were developed in World War II but are still being used today, and the extensive groundwater contamination from that chemical called RDX. It's an explosive at sites across the country as well.
And in one of your pieces, you say, according to federal records, there are close to 200 sites that have been or are still being used to open burn hazardous explosives across the country. So what kind of impact are people worried about in communities where that's going on?
Yeah, that's right. So, you know, one of the worst practices that we've come across is this practice of open burn, and it's basically old munitions, bombs, waste, garbage. They set it afire in a bonfire, and that's a practice that most industries used to follow until the 1980s, when the federal government outlawed it and the EPA enacted regulations to oversee those processes. And the U.S. military is the only entity that continues to do that. And even military operations in other countries have ceased open burning because it basically allows unfiltered toxic emissions out into the atmosphere. And so it's heavy metals, it's chemicals, it's PCBs, a lot of carcinogenic substances, and then from many of these burn grounds, that contamination also seeps into the soil and contaminates groundwater, the aquifers and drinking water supplies underneath these sites. So that's an ongoing, as you said, a couple hundred facilities in the United States are still practicing open burning now. One Badger Army ammunition plant in southern Wisconsin was the site of a lot of controversy around the burning, and there's pretty extensive groundwater contamination there as a result of the open burning practices.
And I think you wrote there were statements the U.S. Senate declared about 30 years ago or so saying, okay, yeah, you get an exemption, you can keep burning for now, but we got to come up with a better plan. And that just hasn't happened.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, when the environmental laws stopped other commercial entities, industry, from open burning, the military stepped forward and said, basically, this is about security, this is about protecting the country, and we don't have an alternative, so if you make us stop burning, then, you know, we're going to basically put our troops in danger. We won't be able to train them, or people will get hurt moving munitions around. And they basically got a pass, an exemption or a temporary reprieve from the law then. But since then, there are a number of alternative technologies that have been developed. I mentioned that the practice was banned, in other countries. Europe, Northern European countries have all banned open burning, and it's in part because there are very effective alternative technologies that the militaries in those countries use to get rid of the same sort of munitions. In the United States, they just have been slow to adopt that, in large part because it can be expensive.
Abram Lustgarten is with us from ProPublica, looking at the disposal of toxic waste, hazardous waste by the U.S. military. Abram, I want to focus in a little bit more on Wisconsin. Now, you mentioned probably the most famous site, the Badger Ammunition Plant. You've got on your chart a total of 61 military installations in Wisconsin that contain at least one hazardous site. All but five are marked on the map and chart as response complete. So, first of all, what does that mean if they're reported as response complete?
So I'm not familiar with those exact sites, but the term response complete is a bit of a term of art from the Pentagon, and what it literally means is that their response is complete. It does not mean what it suggests, I think, to many people, which is that a site has been cleaned up or is somehow safe. So there's a lot of ways that they can reach that category of response complete, and it can include fencing off a facility to try to keep the public out so that they're not endangered by the toxins on that site. It can include determining that another responsible party, as they call it, is at play. So let's say, like, Chevron leased a part of a property for a couple of years, that they're transferring liability for that cleanup over to Chevron, or that's just a hypothetical, but to another entity. So there's all sorts of ways in which the Army concludes its process of environmental liability, and that's essentially what response complete means. And you'll see in the data set that we mapped that many of those response completes come with conditions, like children shouldn't play at this site or people should not have access to this site, even though response is complete.
And we've got at the other end of the spectrum two facilities listed as high risk here in Wisconsin. That's the Anago Air Force Station in Langlade County and, again, the former Badger Army Ammunition Plant in Baraboo in Sauk County. So if a facility in Wisconsin or elsewhere is listed as high risk, what does that mean?
So the risk rating is relative to the Pentagon's other cleanup sites. Generally, it does mean what you would think it would mean, which is that it's not a very safe place to be. But technically what it means is that it's high risk compared to all of the other defense sites, which probably is an understatement of the actual risk. But this just means that of the 40,000 sites that the Pentagon has on its list, that this is the most important, the most likely to endanger public health or public safety.
Now, what does the U.S. military, what does the Pentagon say about the current status of things like open burning of hazardous waste and all these sites that are in various stages of cleanup?
All right. Well, as you might expect, you know, the military emphasizes the efforts that they're making to clean up these sites and the progress that they've made. So they emphasize that they have a $3 to $4 billion annual budget for environmental issues, and about $1.5 billion of that goes directly towards cleanup of these sites. They point to a number of sites that have been cleaned up. And regarding open burning, you know, they say that they're lessening the practice, they're phasing it out over time. You know, that they only do it when it's absolutely necessary. You know, we of course found that wasn't necessarily the case at some of the open burn sites that we looked at. And in my, you know, in my interviewing with Pentagon officials, unofficial interviewing, you know, what I often hear is that there's a feeling of futility within the environmental ranks at the Pentagon, with too many sites, too much of a problem, as big as $1.5 billion is in terms of a funding pot, that it's not quite enough. And so they're kind of in maintenance mode. That money gets spread over, thousands and thousands of sites, and it means a few dollars for each one, and they make some incremental progress on all but, you know, the most critical sites.
I want to key in on a couple points of interest. You write that often cleanup is outsourced to private companies that don't always do very well. And there's one case I think you wrote about in Louisiana where a company had been improperly storing explosives instead of disposing of them, and that was discovered when they exploded.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So what we found, you know, across the board is that a very significant portion of these cleanups get outsourced to environmental contractors. And once that happens, and that outsourcing itself isn't problematic, but once that happens, the oversight really drops off a cliff. So the Pentagon has not, routinely followed up on the performance of their contractors. They kind of wash their hands of it and assume that, you know, because the contract says the site will be cleaned up, it will be. And if you look a layer further, like we did in Louisiana, and we found, you know, we looked at an example where contractor blatantly committed fraud with their site. I mean, they claimed to be taking hazardous waste and recycling it, repurposing it, and in fact were trucking it to an entirely different state and dumping it in a public space. There's criminal investigations that are underway in that case, but what was most interesting to me about it wasn't the crime, but the fact that the Air Force wasn't aware of it. There had been, this particular company had been indicted for similar crimes, fraudulent disposal of hazardous waste, several times before, going back more than a decade, and the Air Force and the Department of Defense had continued to recontract with this company again and again, hundreds of contracts worth tens of millions of dollars. And that was illustrative of this just gap of responsibility between the groups that are actually paid to do something with these dangerous materials and the Pentagon, which is the ultimate entity that's responsible for it.
And one more look at a story. I think this one was in Virginia. Correct me if I'm wrong. One of these open burn of hazardous waste sites. The community, there's a school not too far away. People in the community wanted some kind of testing of air quality by the school in particular. What was the outcome there?
Yes, so that testing has not yet been done. And in fact, that's the same story for any open burn site across the country. These open burns are generally conducted with a permit that the EPA gives the Department of Defense. And that permit is based on essentially a computer model, an estimate for how much pollution they think would potentially emanate from burning this toxic material. And what we reported on was that no one had ever gone out and actually measured what comes from burning this material to confirm whether the models are accurate or to see whether the winds or local weather patterns or local geography might endanger a specific place, more than the EPA permits would hypothesize that they do. And so, as you mentioned, in Virginia, we reported on one open burn site at the Radford Army Ammunition Plant. And it's interesting, that site's interesting because there's an elementary school that's about 1.2 miles directly downwind from the burn pads. People in that community have significant health problems. They're very concerned about their health and about the environment. It's difficult epidemiologically to blame that on a specific cause, but they have a lot of questions. The elementary school is rated in an EPA hazard system to be one of the most at risk in the country, but the Army and the EPA and the state environmental agencies hadn't taken the extra step to actually go and see if the emissions from the burning practices were making their way to this elementary school or to the surrounding community. And that's a pattern of behavior that's the same more or less across the country.
Abram, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That's Abram Lustgarten, senior environmental reporter at ProPublica. He joined us to talk about a new report detailing military toxic waste sites, including those in Wisconsin. You can find a link to that article at WPR.org/Central Time. Coming up, why do we end up with bad or disappointing gifts? A psychologist tells us how we can avoid common gift-giving mistakes. Stay with us here on Central Time. You don't want this to happen to you, but you've probably experienced it anyway. You're celebrating something special. You get a present, you get excited, you unwrap it, and what lies beneath the gift wrap is kind of disappointing. If you're an adult, you've probably received or given countless gifts over several holiday seasons, so why do we keep getting it wrong? Our next guest says it has a lot to do with managing expectations and perceptions of what a good gift is. Amy Gordon is a social personality psychologist who studies what shapes interpersonal relationships. Amy, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Well, you've been writing about this lately. What are some of the main reasons we give the wrong gift?
So it seems like from the research that what we want to get out of gift giving and what we want when we're the gift recipient don't match up. So we have different goals as a gift giver. We want to wow people, you know, give them that surprise they didn't even know that they wanted. And as gift recipients, we just want to get something that we like, that we know that we want. So, you know, as a recipient, you might be happy to put together that Amazon wish list and get any item off of it. But gift givers often have an issue with doing that, right? It feels thoughtless to just click on a link and order something for someone. So we put a lot of time and effort, and often that goes unrewarded because we get it wrong.
So we want to prove how awesome we are and how well we know you by giving you just the right gift.
Part of it. I mean, I think that people have a lot of different goals when they give gifts, and that's definitely part of it. But there's just something about that feeling that you need to be thoughtful behind it, right? That even I know people who are wedding registry, they just are unwilling to buy something off the registry because they feel like it's cheating, that they're supposed to put in the time and effort or it's not going to be valued. And unfortunately, that's not the case. It seems like when we get gifts, we'd much rather just get something off the registry because we put in that time and effort to come up with what we wanted.
Okay, so I'm the same person when I'm giving a gift mm-hmm. or receiving a gift.
Right.
I have opposite motivations both ways. Why can't I learn from gift receiving about how to be a better gift giver?
I don't know. And that's one of the things that actually really fascinates me about this research and this realization as I was reading it and how much I talked to friends and family about the stress of giving gifts, you know, the father who never likes what he gets, but he always wants a gift and you spend, you know, hours and days every Christmas trying to come up with something that he's going to like. And how do we have such a mismatch? Because we're on both sides of it, you know, every year, every time we give and receive gifts. And so I don't know. I think, again, we just get so focused on what our goal is as the giver that we forget what it's like to just be the recipient in that moment. And I find it actually a very fascinating puzzle as to why we can't correctly perspective take in these situations.
Well, it's kind of weird because sometimes, you know, in relationships or with people, we try to watch for hints and maybe give little hints about what we might want, but
right.
we don't want to come out
right.
and say it because that's, you
right.
know, I don't know what, making it too easy or taking the fun out of it. There it is. It's taking the fun out of it.
Right. And I think that's part of it because we do, when we give a gift, want to get something out of it, right? We want that wow moment. We want them to be excited and surprised and we feel like we won't get that if we're just giving them an item they asked for. And I think we also want to feel appreciated, like we put in the time and effort. But that would be great if we could all achieve it, if we could all give that perfect gift. I just think so often we get it wrong and that's worse than having just given them something that maybe wasn't as much of a surprise. I feel like my sister every year tries to beg her husband, I really am not good at being surprised. Don't try. And yet that compulsion to surprise and wow is too strong.
We're talking about the do's and don'ts of gift giving with Amy Gordon. She's a social psychologist. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you play this game? Do you try to give the person the thing that you think they really need that wows them? Does it work? Do you do it right? Or have you gotten it wrong? If you've received gifts, would you rather people just buy the thing off your list? You tell them what they can get you and they get it for you? Or do you like a little mystery? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. So, Amy, how do we change ourselves to just get the gift that the person made it clear that they want?
You know, I think we really have to fight against our instinct in these situations. And writing about this a bit and reading all the research has been helpful for me to just accept that and stop myself when I'm ready to, you know, get something that my husband didn't ask for. And I know after, you know, 15 years together that it's going to probably stress him out more to get an unexpected gift. And yet every year I have to fight that. So I think awareness probably helps, you know, hearing, hey, the research says you should just get someone a gift off their wish list. That's what's going to make them happiest. And to remember that, you know, if your ultimate goal is to please the person you're giving the gift to, that giving them something they want is better. I mean, again, this is all generalities, right? Mm-hmm. My mom loves sentimental gifts. I know that the top of her wish list would be some homemade item. But that is what she wants, and I'm aware of that. So I try to give that to her.
I want to bring on a caller. I'm going to jump in and bring on some callers, Amy. Catherine is with us in Eau Claire. Catherine, hi.
Hi.
So what's your gift-giving story, Catherine?
Yes, well, I just, listening to the story today, I just thought about, you know, the most excited gift that I'm giving this year is actually to my father, and it's a handmade gift. A little while back, he had given me some old dog tags from his past dogs in his life, and I thought, gosh, what am I going to do with these? And so I thought, you know what, I'm going to make a wind chime. And that is the most excited that I've been all Christmas to give him this gift. You know, I've got two small children, but I just can't wait to give this to my father. So, you know, and thinking, you know, what gifts would I be excited to get? And I love handmade things because of that thoughtfulness that's put into it. You know, it's not something that I put on my Amazon wish list or bought at the store. It's I made it and I was creative. So That's my thought.
Catherine, thank you so much. So in a case like this, I think her dad's going to like it. But Amy, in a case like this, is it on you to share the story behind the gift?
I think so. I think that, you know, some of the research I read that I found was really interesting is that people really appreciate items that reflect the giver. So the story behind it, the thought, the why it was important to me to give this to you can help take that gift up, I think, to the next level in that way, for sure, providing that sort of context and story and putting yourself into it. And I definitely am not putting down homemade or thoughtful gifts, and especially if you know the person and know that that's what they love, like my mother, that, you know, that's top of her list always is something that comes from the heart or is meant to be. But identifying the person and knowing whether that's what they care about or not, I think matters.
Catherine, thanks for that call. We'll go next to Christian in Lac du Flambeau. Christian, hi.
Hello, how you doing?
Good. How do you do it?
Well, this year I went with the list.
How come?
Well, it was just a lot easier, you know, instead of trying to figure out what exactly to get, and it saved some time. So,
Christian, thanks a lot. And Amy, the people Christian's giving gifts to are probably going to be happier, and it was easier for Christian.
Yep, I agree. The win-win, as I like to call it.
So as we wrap up, Amy, I mean, the catchphrase is always, well, it's the thought that counts, even when you get that
right.
gift that you know is going to be unused or returned or whatever. Should we stop saying that?
It seems like it. I mean, again, there are definitely thoughtful gifts where it's the thought that counts when you put in time to make, you know, I made personalized picture-based, you know, gifts for my parents this year that they always cry over. So I know those are winners. But it's not, we think that putting in more money or putting in more time is going to make it more appreciated. The thought will count. And that doesn't seem to be the case, that people don't necessarily feel appreciation the way we expect them to when we put in time and effort or money if the gift itself isn't something they value. But as a gift receiver, we can do well, even if we don't like the gift, to try to remember the thought behind it.
Amy,
so not focus, on the item.
Amy, thanks so much.
Yeah.
That's Amy Gordon. She's a social personality psychologist. She joined us to look at why people often don't get gifts they want to receive and how to give better gifts. I'll post my wish list on the Ideas Network Facebook. No, I guess I can't do that. Never mind. Coming up, we'll break down what President Trump had to say this week on national security and what policy changes could be on the way. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. In a speech yesterday, President Trump laid out his administration's national security strategy.
With the strategy I am announcing today, we are declaring that America is in the game and America is going to win.
Among other things, the plan emphasizes a global power struggle among major players like China and Russia. It also reflects the president's America First campaign promise and highlights economic issues here at home. Additionally, the plan includes an emphasis on border security and immigration policy. Gordon Adams joins us now to break down the plan. He's a professor of international relations at American University's School of International Service and a distinguished fellow at the Stimson Center. He's a former senior White House budget official for national security. Gordon, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, Rob.
Well, big picture, did you see a lot new in this speech from the president?
Yes, a good deal new, actually. I would say that this speech and the strategy that accompanies it, a 55-page document that the White House released at the same time, all of it breaks significantly with 70 years worth of tradition in American statecraft. There was a good deal new here that was quite different from the way the United States has engaged the rest of the world.
I want to listen to the president kind of comparing and contrasting with the past a little bit, criticizing past approaches. Here it is.
Our leaders engaged in nation building abroad while they failed to build up and replenish our nation at home. They undercut and shortchanged our men and women in uniform with inadequate resources, unstable funding, and unclear missions.
So, Gordon, what stood out to you as some of the biggest departures you were just pointing out from what the president's predecessors had done?
In the history of American relations with the rest of the world, I would say the tradition for 70 years, with only a slight exception for the first term of George W. Bush, has really been one of what I would call sort of liberal to conservative interventionism. The key words, if you will, were the United States is an exceptional nation, the United States is the indispensable nation, the United States is the global leader. All that language disappears, both in the president's speech and in the document itself. There's no discussion of how unusual we are. There's no discussion of how necessary we are to events around the world. You just heard the president say other presidents engaged in nation building. He doesn't intend to do that. Leadership is left to others if others want to be able to step in and provide leadership. So at the very broad level, this is a step back from the way most every president has related the United States to the rest of the world over the past 70 years.
And that fits in with what President Trump had said on the campaign trail with foreign policy issues. It seemed like his main question was, what's in it for Americans? We don't have an obligation to do things at our expense, on our dime, to help other countries. Is that the core, you think, of what he's talking about?
Absolutely right at the heart of it. It's what I would call assertive nationalism. The document and the president described it as competing in the global situation, competing with the Russians, competing with the Chinese, competing with the Iranians, competing with other nations, but not one where the United States based its engagement on multilateralism, alliances, leadership, being up front, setting the tone. This is a real step towards a, if you will, more in a sense realistic, although I wouldn't call it truly realistic, assertive, competitive view of the way the United States should engage the rest of the world. No more people assuming that they can count on the United States to step in, spend the money, provide the forces, do the leadership.
This was clearly an appealing theme, at least to many Americans. And we've heard calls for this from people more on the left and on the right saying, hey, let's stop spending our money intervening around the globe. Is there anything wrong with that idea?
No, it's in fact, it's interesting that you point that out as a sort of a left-right relationship. There are dimensions of this that are very closely related to what I would call a strategy of restraint. Now, that's different from assertive nationalism in the Trump case. You know, a restraint strategy would basically say we're not going to lead every situation. We're not responsible for every outcome. Other nations need to provide their part. Other nations need to do their job. But there are distinctions here to be made in an assertive nationalist stripe, because the president's strategy is clearly not meant to be multilateral. It is not engaging. In trade terms, he's made it very clear. He thinks trade agreements should be bilateral, not multilateral, and only be written to suit our interests. Now, incidentally, I've never known the United States negotiate a trade agreement that we didn't think was in our interests, but we did many of them as multilateral agreements where everybody had to give a little to get a little, and it sponsored a lot of growth in trade. This president, no way, not going to happen. He confronts the Iranians in this document and in the speech. So rather than stepping back and letting the countries in the Middle Eastern region settle their problems as a restraint policy would do, he wants to step in some way, presumably militarily, because he's not doing nation building here, and assert a dominant position rather than a leadership position in events in the Middle East, particularly in the confrontation with Iran, which is very different from his predecessor. The view towards Russia is kind of a little bit of this and a little bit of that. The document is very confrontational with Russia. The Russians are attacked for cyber intrusion. They're attacked for taking over Crimea. They're attacked for meddling in the Ukraine. They're attacked as a revisionist power, as he said. At the same time, in the middle of his speech, he talks about a very chummy phone call with Vladimir Putin about how wonderful it was for the U.S. to provide intelligence that led the Russians to roll up somebody that was going to do terrorist attacks in St. Petersburg. So there's an edge in assertive nationalism that includes a strong military buildup, great increase in spending, enormous increase in forces promised in this document, a military force, by the way, already dominant globally, but nonetheless even more dominant in the president's view, So this is not really a policy of restraint. It's a policy of challenge and competition, but it's not a policy of engagement and multilateral leadership.
Talking to Gordon Adams from American University. He's at the School of International Service there, talking about President Trump's speech and then an accompanying document on national security policy. You mentioned Russia and China. Here's a moment where President Trump addressed them in that speech.
We also face rival powers, Russia and China, that seek to challenge American influence, values, and wealth. We will attempt to build a great partnership with those and other countries, but in a manner that always protects our national interest.
Is that much different from how we've been approaching Russia and China, working with them when we can, trying to restrain their influence when we need to?
Rob, if he'd said it the way you said it, it wouldn't be very different. What he said was, these countries are revisionist powers that challenge American interests, values, and wealth. That's a rather confrontational framework for what he wants to do. He's clear about Russia. He's prepared to do business on some things with Putin. It's not clear what the challenge is going to be, but the Russians are very critical of the strategy in response today. The Chinese situation is going to be, I think, the most interesting to watch, because the strategy, in a way, recognizes that China is a rising power. It seems to want to prevent that rise. It seems to want to compete with and, if you will, contain the rise of China. The risk in an assertive nationalist strategy like this is that in seeking to confront, compete, and contain, you raise the stakes of the confrontations with China. At the same time, you make the kind of cooperation, words that are in the document, much more difficult to accomplish, because the Chinese are going to look at the American stance, military, Pacific deployments, and so on, and say, gee, maybe we better tool up and continue our buildup, because the Americans are now challenging us in our space in the Western Pacific, and so we're going to build up more. So there's a confrontational side. The document talks more about cooperation than the president talked about cooperation. So that's a dimension that's really going to be worth watching, especially as it concerns China.
Now, there's staying with China, there's national security and there's trade, and those seem like they might come into conflict, because one of the first things President Trump did, he had promised to pull us out of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, a U.S.-led, in many ways, trade deal with lots of countries, not China. Is there a tension there, a conflict?
Yes, there very clearly is a conflict. Mind you, it's not a conflict that other presidents have not had to deal with. Trade relationships with China have always been problematic. Intellectual property rights in China have always been a challenging issue for the United States. The national security issues have generally been divided. That is to say, with China, we really want and need their cooperation with respect to the North Korean nuclear program. The Chinese have a lot of influence in North Korea. And Trump has tried to play that thread of influence, as has Tillerson, as has General Mattis, the National Security Advisor, H.R. McMaster. At the same time, there is an assertion of confrontation here about the Chinese efforts to create a further out territorial water contained by a ring of islands, some of which they are building in the South China Sea. There's concern about Chinese influence with traditional American allies in the region, Japan, Australia, Malaysia, Thailand, Vietnam even, where the United States has been developing a relationship. So there are elements of both in this strategy. But what's really interesting about the strategy is, in a broad sense, it emphasizes the military dimension of American statecraft. This, to my view, is one of the most difficult pieces of the Trump strategy. It emphasizes military power. In the document, it says diplomacy is also critical, and they want to put diplomacy and military power and foreign assistance together. The problem in reality is, when you look at what the president has actually done to the State Department and what Secretary Tillerson is doing at the State Department, they proposed cutting the State Department's budget by a third. They proposed taking 2,500 people, that's about 25%, out of the Foreign Service. So they are diminishing the tools of statecraft on the civilian side while they are calling for an unprecedented military buildup. So the balance in what they are actually doing is different from the balance of the language in the document.
We're talking right now about President Trump's approach to national security, which he laid out in a speech yesterday. Our guest is Gordon Adams, professor of international relations at American University's School of International Service. He says there's something to see here. There are significant changes, significant breaks with the past. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of the Trump administration's approach to issues of national security and foreign policy? Do you agree with the idea of America first as it relates to foreign policy? Should we be prioritizing military might and military expenditures over diplomacy? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're continuing our conversation now about President Trump's approach to national security and the plan he outlined yesterday in a speech. Gordon Adams is with us, professor of international relations at American University's School of International Service. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your reactions to that speech yesterday, your questions for our guest. Should we be prioritizing military over diplomacy or the other way around? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Let's go to our callers. Jacob is with us in Genoa City. Jacob, hi.
Hey, how are you doing today?
Good. What do you think?
I don't know. Personally, I feel like it's very important that instead of extending a stick, as President Donald Trump is saying, that we should extend a hand to all other countries. As I feel like as you antagonize people more and more, it only escalates problems to a point where they can no longer really be solved. And it just makes everything bigger and blown out of proportion more.
Jacob, thanks for the call. Gordon, what do you think? He's worried, as you were mentioning earlier, Gordon, about a maybe aggressive approach, but generating more opposition.
I think that's one of the real downside risks here. You know, Teddy Roosevelt was famous for coining the phrase, speak softly but carry a big stick. I would say that if you wanted to kind of, you know, reducing it to a slightly absurd level, characterize the Trump strategy, it would be speak loudly and carry a big stick. So a very assertive, strength-based approach, peace through strength featured in the document. Not a hand extension, as Jacob said. There's not a strong extension of the hand here, really, to anybody. While there's language that talks about cooperation buried in the 55 pages of text, mostly this is about confrontation. The approach, let's say, to the Middle East, for example, is all about confronting Iran. It's not about extending a hand to a process that might bring peace to Syria. While the document says the United States wants to play a role there, the truth is the United States has become the dispensable nation, if you will. We're left out of the Syrian process. And nothing that is in this document suggests to me that there's a reason why the Russians, the Turks, the Iranians, and the Syrian government in Damascus would want to invite the United States in. It's just not seen as a player here. So speaking loudly and carry a big stick has an especially strong downside risk when you're dealing with the world we're dealing with today. Because in this world, power really is rebalancing. Other countries, China, Russia, Turkey, India, are rising. They're acquiring power. As they do, the relative capacity of the U.S. to tell anybody what to do is diminishing. And so the challenge really is going to be, how does the United States play in a world where power has actually rebalanced? It's not about revisionist powers. That's done. The revisionist powers are rising powers, and they are strong enough now that the United States simply can't compel the system to behave the way we might like it to behave. If we decide, as Trump seems to have decided, that dealing with that rebalanced world involves much stronger military force and a more aggressive use of military force, it seems to me the absolutely logical conclusion is that other countries are going to arm up as well to make sure that they can contain the United States.
Jacob, thanks for that call. We'll go next to Paul with us in Austin, Minnesota. Paul, hi.
Hi.
What do you want to bring up, Paul?
I guess what I want to bring up is, I think Donald Trump is right that we don't need to police the whole world and let these countries t- take care of themselves to the point where if we need to step in, we do. But for the most part, they need to take care of their own stuff.
Paul, thanks for the call. And people have talked about, for better or worse, the U.S. being the world's policeman. Gordon, are we moving away from that?
Yes, I think yes and no in the Trump strategy. I mean, I think one of the more interesting and attractive features, and it really is not Trump, it's the experience of Iraq and Afghanistan. Americans, and this was popular in the campaign, Americans are really tired of having the United States appear to be the one that always needs to step in and solve things. Now, I can understand that fatigue. At the same time, the reason for 70 years the United States seemed to step in and solve things is frankly because it was in our interest to do so. The United States has never failed to pursue a foreign policy that suited American interests, but it's been very interventionist. And I think what a lot of people like Paul are saying is we don't need to do all of these things that we've been doing. And I agree with that. I think that's absolutely right. We don't need to. And continuing to try to do now all those things is pushing against a changing world where a lot of countries don't want us coming in and doing those things either. I mean, it's not that other countries haven't been able to deal with their own problems. In some regions, you've just got problems that aren't going to be easily to resolve. Middle East comes to mind. There's no one country, including the United States, right now, today, capable of solving the religio-ethnic, nationalist conflicts that are going on in the Middle East. Sadly, to some extent, I think we're going to have to watch them play themselves out. But the assumption of 70 years has been we're the leader, we're indispensable, we must be there. The assumption of the Trump assertive nationalism is we're going to be in lots of places, but we're going to just do it on our own unilaterally. And if others want to come along, that's fine, and everybody else can take care of themselves. So there's a dimension of confrontation there that is different from really restraint, which would say we can't solve all these problems, and we are, in fact, not going to step in and confront the Iranians all over the Middle East and so on. There's some very different ways of viewing how we will engage the world. Trump's is one of them.
Paul, thanks for that call. We're talking to Gordon Adams from American University about American foreign policy. Gordon, before we run out of time, I wanted to ask about something that wasn't, I understand, in the speech or I think in the document that much, climate change and global warming, which the Pentagon has been worried about, which past administrations have been. What do you make of that absence?
It is very striking, that absence, and I attribute it more to the kind of domestic constituency relationships that President Trump has built in his campaign and in his presidency, where to put in climate change, in effect, concedes domestic political ground. It says, well, maybe there's something to this climate change thing. The administration from the EPA across the board, except the Pentagon, which is very interesting, has basically wiped climate change from the vocabulary. To put it in this document would have been a step back in the framework they've been trying to build. So it only appears, I think, in the use of renewables twice, but really in the framework of energy dominance. Literally, that's the language of the document. The United States will have energy dominance, and that includes coal, oil, and then they add renewables, third on the list. The economy is changing anyway. Companies are switching to renewables anyway. Automobile companies are getting rid of, fossil fuel-driven cars. It's all happening, so there's a real lack of realism in acknowledging climate change, but it is domestically, politically consistent, and it's consistent with one of his big non-multilateral assertive decisions, which was to step out of the Paris Accord earlier this year and say we're not going to be part of that agreement. It's not good for the American economy. So I wasn't surprised climate change wasn't there, even though the Pentagon, they know full well that there are all kinds of consequences of climate change they're going to have to deal with.
Gordon, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That's Gordon Adams, professor of international relations at American University's School of International Service. He's a distinguished fellow at the Stimson Center. He's a former senior White House budget official for national security, and he joined us today to talk about President Trump's national security plan outlined in a speech yesterday.